Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
You know, if one of your strains of starter culture dies, you've got lots of others. I love hybrid vigor, and it's the same for culture. You know, we don't, like, monoculture doesn't work in farming, and it doesn't work in humanity either. That's my new, that's how to bring cheese into the modern world.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of the Delicious Legacy Podcast. My name is Thomas Dinas, and on each episode, I'm going to take you to a different ancient gastronomic adventure. Strap in while we're traveling back in time and enjoy our delicious adventures. On this episode, I've had the pleasure to chat with Ned Palmer, author and cheesemonger, champion of British cheese for over 20 years now. He's been a guest on my podcast before when we talked about the long history of cheese. This time round, he rejoins me in Borough Market, the mecca of fresh produce in London, and where Ned started his career as a young cheesemonger all those years ago. Here, we delve in a conversation about superb British and Irish cheeses, what makes a Scottish cheddar different but equally fantastic to an English cheddar, from Somerset, for example, and what that has to do with terroir. We talk about flavour profiles and what this means for different cheeses, and some surprising tasting notes that he found in many regional cheeses. We tried to find the role and the place of British cheeses in our modern and ever-changing UK and world, and the challenge these cheesemakers face. Finally, for Patreon backers only, Ned gives us some of his wisdom as to what beer to pair with cheese. I hope you will enjoy. Subscribe and back the podcast on Patreon if you want to find out more. Look, you are a philosopher, yes. Like Socrates.
Well, yes, there is.
There's that. Only one thing we know, that we don't know anything.
So, a recovering philosopher. Like, I'm trying to get over that, but it's really true. It's really true.
What's a philosopher? I suppose
always a philosopher, yeah. I think so.
Recovering, yeah.
You know, there were a lot in the dairy, there's a lot in the world of cheese.
I don't get that. I mean,
I do, I completely get that. Yeah, yeah. Are we recording? Because it is a good point.
We're recording, yeah.
So, one thing, really simply, it's just about rigor. Like, when you're studying philosophy or being a philosopher, there's an absolute rigor about. What does this sentence mean? You know, or what am I saying when I say this? What is the argument? What logical conclusions follow from this if I say this thing, if I, you know, take this position? And if you're making cheese, I mean, you have to be absolutely rigorous. You know, if the temperature is like a degree over what it's meant to be, it's going to be a different outcome. If you put the rennet in at a slightly different time, that's going to change things. So there's this complete kind of rigor about doing it. But there's also, cheese is a complex system, and I think it's factual in the proper sense of the word. But the deeper you looked into any part of it, the more complexity there would be.
Yeah.
So it takes a sort of philosophical mind when you're making cheese to be kind of thinking, well, what was going on there, and what were those variables? How did they affect it? How can we change them? Not everyone makes cheese like that.
Yeah.
But I think that the Zen masters of cheesemaking, like Mary Holbrook said, they did it, just not consciously. But yeah, they were still being philosophers, but in a more zen way of doing it. So, yeah, philosophy and cheese.
Exactly. Because
Yeah, it has the scientific bit, but also it's not about that. It's not about creating a scientific exact product. It's something that it has to have a character.
It really,
and it has a character.
Yeah, it does.
Robert Good Cheese has a character.
Exactly, and I really like the word character because even if you get a very scientific cheesemaker like Bill Oglethorpe, or a very empirical cheesemaker, so he has a stopwatch, and you know when you put the rennet in, or when you put the starter culture in, say you click the stopwatch, so that when you put the rennet in, you know exactly to the millisecond when you put it in, and you measure that and you record it, and it may change over the year, but you're tracking all of that, and he uses various tech to say check acidity, but at the same time, he knows that there's a mystery to it, and he knows that he's not in 100% control of what he's doing. And that's where the character comes, I think. That's where that comes.
That's great.
And character is so interesting, isn't it? And I think, in a sense, it's the imponderable thing. What makes this cheddar different from that cheddar if they're made a few miles down the road from each other? And there might absolutely be that one of the fields has more chalk in it or less clay or something. And it might be that the breed is slightly different, it's a different herd. But then there's just the way that Jamie does it with his hands and the way that George does it with his hands that they couldn't even necessarily say if they said what it was that they did that was different. And it sounds romantic, and it is romantic, but I also think it's a real thing, a real effect. As is terroir.
Yeah, which we're going to talk about in extent, I suppose.
Yeah.
But let's start from the beginning,
start
I suppose.
From the beginning. Yeah.
Lovely. So, cheers, Ned.
Cheers,
thanks,
Tom.
Thanks for coming to the podcast again.
Thanks for having me.
2 years, almost to the dot.
I know,
the last time.
That went quickly.
And, you have a new book out.
I do have a new book out.
Brilliant.
So it's called A Cheesemonger's Compendium of British and Irish Cheese, because I'm good at titles. And it is, what that says, it's a treasury of about 150 cheeses from all over Britain, Ireland, Wales, Scotland, or the island of Ireland. And it was kind of my lockdown homework. So I was supposed to write A Cheesemonger's Tour of France, which meant going to France. So obviously in 2020 that couldn't happen. So my editor said, why don't you do this first? And I realised when I started off that I only knew 50 cheeses really well. And there are 50 cheeses in the first book, Cheesemonger's History. So I needed to taste 100 new cheeses. And this I did with my long-suffering wife, Imogen Robertson, great author of historical fiction, and long-suffering wife of a cheesemonger. I decided that we would taste them at 7 in the morning to make like a routine of it. So I would get this delivery of cheese. And it'd be all sorts of reeking cheeses from Wales, these washed rinds and that, you know. And then we would sit there at 7 in the morning having about 5 or 6 cheeses.
I mean, will you marry me?
Yeah, I know, right? You can come and stay. The neighbours started, like, blenching when they saw me coming down the drive because I'd be like, do you want some cheese? Because I'd had so much cheese. I had to give it away to all the neighbours. So, yes, there's about 150 cheeses. It's got short descriptions of each cheese, what they taste like and look like, a little bit of story, a bit of folklore or something. So they're like a treasury of cheeses.
Which is great, I suppose, because, if you think about it, we hear about so many different British cheeses and the renaissance of British cheese, but we don't actually know many more than the obvious ones, like cheddar, Stilton, some fresco cheese.
And I think we're all guilty of that. And it's not a sin either. I mean, to start with, when you talk about cheddar and Stilton, you're talking about two of the greatest cheeses in the world. And then the territorials like Lancashire and Caerphilly and Red Leicester. These are all amazing cheeses. And they are the ones that have come to mind first, I guess, for anyone, even a sort of cheese amateur. I don't know what to call it, an enthusiastic amateur. But even I found out that there were, there were at least 100 and far more than 100 for me to taste. And apologies to all the people that didn't get in. It's only because I could only eat so much cheese. And books can't be infinite.
That's true, yeah. The first thing, I don't think it's true. You can eat.
Really? I can eat a lot.
Cheese a lot.
I mean, in terms of the book being infinite, while I was writing the book, new cheeses were appearing, which was driving me nuts. You know, the manuscript was prized to my hands, and I'm like, wait, Martin's got a new one. I need to stick it in. And particularly, I think, in Martin's case, in Martin Gottmik's, James and a bunch of other choosers, his reaction to lockdown and the exigencies of lockdown, all the stress and the stress, was to make more kinds of cheese.
Brilliant.
I'll just, you know, try a bunch of different stuff, see what works.
So yeah, the number 150 was arbitrary, or
it was like enough. Was it arbitary? It was kind of what will fit in a book, roughly speaking. The number climbed up, and also the number is indeterminate. So, I think on some copy it says 150 cheeses. I think in the flyleaf here it says 158. I think I've counted 164, but I also have a theory. You know those rings of standing stones, the Neolithic stones? And you know, like, there's often a superstition that no one can count the exact number of stones? Right. I think it's the same with the cheeses in my book.
No one can count the
basically, cheese. It's a mystical cheese book.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I love it already. Okay, you told me what is it about.
Yeah.
But is there anything like this out there, like similar?
There are. There are lots, and they're all great.
What makes your book unique?
I think that I wrote it. I mean, I don't mean that in a prideful way. I mean, I've got the cheeses I like. I've got the flavours that my palate notices and the ones that I like. So they'll probably appear more with me trying to be objective.
Yeah.
The way that I talk about them. Because I'm interested in folklore and history, the descriptions tend to have little bits of that in. If you look at other books, I think Julia Harbutt's amazing Book of World Cheeses, much more focused just on the actual taste, you know, the organoleptic qualities of the cheese and something about the maker and where they're from. So it does that.
Yeah.
I mean, I also, you know, I think that there's plenty of space for everyone to write a list book, because list books are obsolete even before they're published, because people keep making new cheeses. And also, you know, I taste a cheese for the first time ever, and it's a three-month-old, whatever it is, a three-month-old Smith's cheddar. And I go, oh, that's very nice, very young, very delicate, very gentle. Someone else writes a book, and they taste the 12-month-old cheddar.
And it's a completely different thing.
It's a completely different thing. And they would write a different thing about it. Yeah. So I think there's room for everyone.
Lovely. We have to tell, obviously, to the listeners that we are out in Borough Market.
Yes.
And this is your spiritual home in a way.
It kind of is, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, the reason I'm a cheesemonger is coming to sell cheese at Borough Market. And it was coming here to sell Gorworth Caerphilly that my mate Todd made. I'd never done anything like it before. I never sold retail. I never had any truck with fancy food. And I had a bit of his cheese, and I realised that all the cheese I'd ever had before in my life was rubbish. And that basically turned me into a cheesemonger, in the sense that the rest of my life is devoted to the quest, why? And why is that so good? Why isn't all cheese like that?
Yeah.
You know, why did I not get it for ages? And why are the British not famous as they should be for their cheese, if we make all these amazing cheeses? No, so Todd quickly got me a job at Neil's Yard Dairy to stop me bothering him. But I started, that was in 2000. And so, yeah, I've been involved with it. No, and then I ended up running the Caerphilly store in the market for a while. When we got married at Peckham Registry, the first thing we did was come to the market, you know, to say hi to people and have our lunch at Elliot's. So, yeah, it's always been part of it.
That's brilliant. So, yeah, it's an excellent place to have our chat today, I think.
Yeah, isn't it? It's perfect. Also, there's beer.
And cheese.
And cheese. We should get some cheese in a bit, shouldn't we?
We'll get some later on, I guess.
Yeah.
Great. So, okay. My first deep question is, obviously, we have 150 cheeses.
Yeah.
But if I had to ask you, really hard, to choose one from each country of the British Isles, what would you do?
Yeah.
What would you choose?
Well, it's nice of you to give me five. And that has made it slightly less painful, because the question, you know, what's your favourite cheese, gets asked a lot. And
it does.
It's physically painful, because, you know, if there are thousands of cheeses.
I just can't answer this question. There's no...
Yeah.
You cannot choose one cheese.
And also, what I like about it is, you know, through eating 100 new cheeses, I found a lot of new cheeses, and I found a lot of new flavours, and I learned something about terroir.
Mm.
One cheese. Let's talk about that, because I know we're going to talk about
terroir.
So for me, for Scotland, there's a cheddar called St Andrews, And the thing about it, I'll just look it up so we can say who it's made by for everyone. It's made by Jane Stewart. It's made in Fife. So it's made on the east coast of Scotland. Now, there's a terroir of cheddar, as in cheddar gets its character from where it's from. And Scottish cheddar tends to look more pale than Somerset cheddar because the grazing is different. The grass is less rich. The temperature's cooler, you get less growth. So you get a paler colour. The grass gives it that.
Yeah.
No less delicious, you know, but it's a different thing. When I looked at the St. Andrew's cheddar, it is paler than Somerset cheddar, but it's darker than the Isle of Mull, which is over on the west coast.
Of course.
And this is to do with the different grass, the way it grows. There's more rain on the Isle of Mull. I think it's a bit warmer on the east coast. And you can see it. So I learned this thing, that there's a terroir of Scottish cheddar, and that the really attuned cheese fanatic can tell the difference between a west and east coast cheddar. So you want to be able to go into shop, oh, I see you have some east coast cheddar. Excellent.
Yeah,
so that was a revelation to me. And it's a delicious cheese, and it has a very different character to Somerset. It's got more moisture in it. It's got something slightly farmyardy. I know it's a bit boozy. As if there's some fermentation going on. Just a really, really delicious cheese that really expresses its place. There's also sort of English cheese imperialism, because cheddar kind of almost wiped out the Scottish indigenous cheese, Dunlop, the similar cheese, hard cheese. And cheddar became so popular and so successful, a lot of cheesemakers would go over to it. And we nearly lost Dunlop through a sort of inadvertent English cheese imperialism. So it's kind of nice to see the Scots fighting back the really great cheddar.
That's great.
I love that.
So
England. So England, one of the most fascinating cheeses I've ever eaten is called Witheridge. It's made in Hampshire by Nettlebed Creamery. And the thing is, it's matured in hay. And I've seen hard cheeses in the Alps that have a coating of hay or flowers on them, and there is some flavour permeating the cheese, and they look beautiful. But I've never seen this soft cheese. It's almost a washed rind. Looks like a pinky bone.
Oh, wow, okay.
Which has been wrapped in hay. And this is what cheesemakers are like. You know, I was saying they're like philosophers. They grew the hay especially, like a certain mix of seeds, to make the right hay to mature their cheeses in, and then dried it out, you know. And I bet there was a drying regime to work out what was the optimal speed at which to reduce that moisture to wrap the cheese in. And it just gives it this amazing flavour, slightly beery.
Right,
of course. Kind of malty, and maybe the cheese is still a bit... the hay was still a bit moist or something, but just so singular, and I'd really never had flavours like that in a cheese before. And comparatively new, you know, Nettlebed Creamery. You know, we're not talking about Montgomery's, it's been going for 150 years or something. So that was exciting. I mean, this is so reductive, obviously.
I know.
But here we go. Wales, I was thinking of, there's a fella, also has one of the best names ever. He's called John Savage Onsveder. And he's a Dutch Welshman, or a Welsh Dutchman, or he was a Dutchman that came over to Wales.
And now he's adopted,
makes cheese. And he makes cheeses that are sometimes a mix of, say, Welsh cheese and Dutch style.
Okay.
And so when you talk about terroir, you could talk about culture, not just soil, but how people make cheese and why and that. And if you emigrated from Holland to Wales, you would take some of that cheese making culture with you, some of the technique, and that would just affect how you did it.
Of course.
Even not the tech, it would just be how you liked it when you tasted the curd. That would affect how you made it. So you could say that character would get into the cheese. And this one that, well, John and his team or his family make it's called Saval, and it's a wash rind. So these are the cheeses washed in brine. They grow bacterial rind on. The rind has those barnyardy farming flavours, the ones we're not supposed to say out loud. My editor keeps editing out every time I put what I really mean in, but, you know, very human flavours, very intimate.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, it's a kefili. So it's a kefili recipe, but then the rind is washed.
Okay,
which
that
is
sounds...
a more northern European...
That sounds, yeah, very interesting. Very
and
different.
So I'll just read my flavour description, because I think I'll better it, actually. It just says, opening with a pronounced whiff of the farm, the first flavour I pick up is sweetness, opening out into white chocolate with a trace of estuary fruitiness, finishing on a tingling acidity. And, you know, that's all true. It's got that barnyardy stuff. It's oddly sweet. And you get white chocolate in cheeses sometimes. I know that sounds bizarre.
That sounds bizarre,
often in mountain cheeses like Comté or Beaufort particularly, I get white chocolate.
Oh, wow, okay.
And that estery fruitiness is possibly, well, esters giving that kind of boozy, fruity note to it.
It sounds like a great cheese. I have to try that.
It's really good. It's really good. Also,
where can I find it?
Well, I mean, here is the thing that, you know...
Online.
Even in modern life, with online sales and all of that... I was just going back to why don't we see it? Because of this, you know, the division between the countries still pertains. And you're more likely to find some in a shop in Wales than you are in London, sadly. And let's fix that. But
fair
online
enough.
Ordering, the Welsh Cheese Company is really good. And they have lots of Welsh cheese, funnily enough. And they do great packaging. It's really sustainable, but it's just beautiful. Like, almost it's like getting a present. So you get Saval from them. He also brought a teak vat from Holland with him. So made a teak hardwood, a very, very beautiful thing. If anyone worried about hardwood cutting in forests, I reckon it might be 100 years old. So
yeah,
there would be a forest.
At least.
And well seasoned by all that cheese making. And that's just a lovely idea as well, to bring the vat over. Ireland is full of cheese.
Today's episode is brought to you with the welcome support of Maltby & Creek, UK's leading Greek delicatessen, supplier and distributor of premium Greek produce, be it wine, herbs, cheeses or olive oil, from all over the wild corners of Greece and working directly with small artisan producers. Maltby & Creek has many varieties of Greek cheeses from all over the Greek world. And you'll find cheeses like Cretan Graviera from Sfakia, from the wild mountains of Sfakia in the south of Crete, Arsenico from Naxos, Xyrotiri cheese from Samothrake, and the best ever feta outside of Greece, Costarellos barrel-aged feta. And you can enjoy all these cheeses in UK from Maltby & Creek. Maltby & Creek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. You can shop online and have the exquisite goods delivered to your doorstep across the UK, or you can visit the shop at Arch 17 Apollo Business Park, Lucy Way, SE16 4ET, Bermondsey, London. And, of course, for all you dear listeners, Maltby & Creek has an amazing discount of 15% off your next purchase. So go online, go to the website and type maltbyandgreek.com/delicious and you get 15% discount at the checkout.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ireland, Ireland, Ireland is full
again,
of cheese.
Again, that's something we don't really know about Ireland,
well,
do we?
Yeah, and that, and we are so wrong not to know that, because it's called the Emerald Isle. And it's called the Emerald Isle, like when you fly over it, if it's not cloudy, which is quite rare, you'll see why, because the green of the field is so green. With such excellent pasture and lots of rain. The animals love it. And they talked about, like you almost just scrape the butter off the legs of your cow because you just walk through the field and it'd be that rich, the grass. So it really has always been a big area for dairy farming. Sadly, again, the English kind of spoiled it a bit because they turned it over to grain while they took the land off the Irish people, sort of pastoral farmers, and turned it over to grain when they lost all their grain in the Hundred Years' War in their territories in France that they lost.
Right, okay.
A terrible thing, but since the 19th century, the Irish have been making more cheese and going more and more to their own styles. They started out making things like cheddar and Stilton, but then they went to, particularly from the 70s, you know, that Renaissance, making their own style. So this is a goat's cheese called Clonmore, and the thing about it is that it tastes of roasted peanuts, and it's not a flavour note that I often encounter in the cheese. Once before, in Gabeen, actually, in County Cork, so also County Cork. I don't know if that's the soil, but roasted peanuts, also floral, very gentle goat. So people who don't like goat's milk, this one is. It's really gentle. It's got amazing ivory colour, looks like vellum, like old parchment. And goat's cheese is usually really pure white, and this has this lovely vellum colour. So it's surprising in a lot of ways. Also, hard goat's cheese, which this is, really hard to make.
Yeah.
Very difficult. Most goat's cheese is soft. You know, the milk doesn't coagulate. It's a really skillful cheese making.
Oh, wow.
Right, Northern Ireland. The thing about Ireland is there's an awful lot of cheese made in County Cork. I mean, a wonderful lot of cheese made in County Cork. And it's slightly embarrassing because if you look at my map in the back, you know, there's a lot of cheeses in County Cork. And then there's some in Wicklow, you know, that's great, Tipperary, Bart. I think the land must be really great. And it was where the Renaissance there kind of began with Millines and a woman called Veronica Steele.
Yeah.
70s. But I did try and get some cheese from other bits. And in Northern Ireland, there seem to be fewer cheeses around. And that might just be so far. I think that the Renaissance is still building.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's also yet to do with soil or climate as well. But there were such a fewer per mile. But one of them, it's called Young Buck. And even the name, I love it because this is a cheeky name. So it's an unpasteurised Stilton style. You're not allowed to make unpasteurised cheese and call it Stilton. But you can't make Stilton in Ireland. It has to be made in Nottinghamshire, Leicestershire or Derbyshire, in English counties. So Michael Thompson, who makes it, he went there. He went to England to make cheese, particularly at Stitchelton Dairy with Joe Schneider, making raw milk Stilton style cheese. And he wanted to call it Stitchelton. He said, because isn't it a new
yeah,
style?
Yeah.
And Joe said, no, you can't. Like, you know, it's mine, but also we should be able to call it Stilton, you know. Mm. So he's still lobbying for that. So Michael called it Young Buck, and it's like, you know, the young guy, the new kid on the block. It's slightly cheeky. I love it. It's a rambunctious cheese. It can be really intense, and it can be quite variable in a cool way for you. And where a lot of people praise, they prize consistency in cheese making, blue cheese particularly. You want a nice even spread. I'm miming this and our listeners can't see, but I'm miming an even spread of vein suet cheese, so it looks like marble.
Yeah.
And Young Buck doesn't necessarily do that so much. It's not necessarily such an even spread. And I love it. You get almost different flavours. You get a banana-y, estery flavour sometimes around the rind. Another flavour you wouldn't expect, bananas. And it is the artificial foam banana flavour. Is what I get.
That's insane.
Which actually, you know, and this is just a sidebar, the so-called artificial banana flavour, you probably know this, it's actually based on an original banana that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
All the bananas, I think, one
variety. Yes,
variety.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And so what tastes like artificial is actually true native, you know, land-raised banana. Well, that's what his jeans taste of, as well as the peppery blue. And, you know, a lot of umami and that. And they look quite gnarly. So I like to think they've got a gnarly...
Because you have a Stilton, which is very creamy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have Stilton, which is a little bit...
firmer. Yeah.
And then this one has a very different character.
It does, and it's more like... It is like a mix between the two. And it's interesting you say that. So I am a Niels Rahr dairy cheese man, even though I haven't been one for more than 10 years. Like, you kind of are. You never really knew. And to me, Stilton is creamy, and that's how it tasted. And it was aged until it got creamy, and it was aged until a certain acidity that's in the young cheese mellowed out into something more rich. So that, for me, is that Stilton. Now, you get other creameries that make Stilton that make it harder and more acidic. And I have to admit, finally, after years of trying to grow up, that that's fine. And it is just a different philosophy of cheese making. It's not incorrect. But, you know, the dairy dies hard in a man, you know. And then Young Buck is an interesting mixture of that. Firm, but still quite moist with bits of creamy, or it might, you know, shade to a creaminess. And its acidity is somewhere between that really rounded out and that more sharp. So everything has its character. Was that five? I think it was
that's
five.
That's five. Cool. We've done.
I could count five to five.
So basically, what you're saying is that the terroir is really important. Basically,
the terroir is really important.
It's important.
Yeah.
As important as the skills of the cheese maker.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there would be argument about this. And before one gets too romantic and starts talking about the taste of the soil, I know that there are eminent cheesemongers, and I think they've got science to back them up, that say that there's not that much character coming through. It's much more about the make. And I think the classic example is a Scottish cheddar called Isle of Mull. And they feed the cattle on a lot of draff, which is the barley mash from whiskey making. Now, it's terroir to a tea. Okay, I don't know where they get the barley from, but that is the barley mash they make Tobermory whiskey from on the island. And then they feed that to cows. And I've always reckoned that you can taste something like whiskey in the cheese, a bit of iodine, a bit of peat. That, you know, is that character of a Tobermory is what I want. It is also said that no, you can't. It just, those flavours don't really come through in milk so much. It was a bit romantic. I want to believe it does. But then there are a lot of things, I think, to what we mean when we say terroir, if that's what you want to.
Yeah, it's a more broad
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not about the soil itself, but it's about the feed of the animal, the climate, the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I also, I love the way you distinguish between climate and weather, because I think that's really true. That, you know, if you make, if you had cheese in a wetter year, it would be different from a really hot, dry year.
Yeah.
And then also, so everything you say is true, and the word comes from terroir, it's from terre, from soil, from earth. Originally, they talked about the taste of terroir in food, that by now I mean the French.
Yeah.
And maybe this is the 16th, 17th century. Maybe earlier. And un goût de terroir, the taste, and they really meant the taste of the earth. And they said this thing, the taste of the earth. And they said, or I think actually it was one of the Roman agricultural writers said, to know if land is good, you would put the soil into the water and some water and swizzle it about and drink it. And if it tastes good, it's good soil to grow things on. Which is gorgeous. And I mean, I'm not saying that a farmer couldn't taste soil and maybe think, oh, well, I'm not going to buy that field off Joe. Or, yeah, no, we need to plough some seaweed into this. But it comes from earth.
Yeah.
And yet it means so much more. And the next thing above weather, climate, soil, elevation, topography, height above sea level is culture, is people. And what happened to the people such that they needed to make a big hard cheese like cheddar? Or why do the Greeks make brined cheese like feta? You know, what are the economic reasons? Or what do they believe?
Indeed, yeah, everything plays a role, yeah. And that kind of leads me to the next part, of the next question perhaps, that it has to do, what are the British cheeses, the place of the British cheeses in our table, basically? How in the modern world, basically. What's the role of the British cheese?
Role of British cheese in the modern world.
Yeah.
Wicked. This sounds like this is like my finals dissertation for my master's in cheese. I love it. The role of cheese in the modern world. I love it. It's a really lovely and interesting question, and I know that you know that we could talk about the Renaissance that began in the 70s, and we could talk about the need for that. The reason for that need was that so much of our cheese was gone, and that so much was made in factories, and people, we were losing those, even the knowledge of making our traditional varieties, or even making cheese in an artisanal traditional way, like, not let alone, you know, how to do that with a Lancashire or a cheddar. So that was happening, and there was a oddly a benefit to that, I think, in that cheesemakers in Britain and in Ireland were happy to innovate and play around and use different recipes because they had to.
Right.
But they could develop, you know, new varieties of cheese that didn't exist before. So the Jones brothers kind of invented, with Doogie Campbell, invented Lincolnshire Poacher, which is a mix of Gruyere and cheddar.
Yeah.
If you take a country like France that's managed to preserve so much more of its tradition, it's vanishingly rare. I've never heard of a French cheesemaker who says, "Oh, I love that Stilton. I'm going to make a cheese that's a mixture between Stilton and Roquefort." You know, never heard of it. May exist. I hope it does. Never heard of it. So you start with this thing that we British and Irish cheesemakers are comfortable with playing and inventing new cheeses or developing hybrid. That did not valorise our traditional cheeses like Lancashire, Cheshire, Red Leicester, Double Gloucester, Wesel. And I'm talking about a specific family called the Territorials. When you say Territorials to English people, British people, they tend to think you mean those part-time soldiers. And they've never heard of this unique family of cheeses that only exists in Britain. And I would almost... they're kind of English, really. And I think you could almost say they originate around Cheshire and its success in the 17th century.
Right.
And it grows from there. Except Dunlop. And another thing for me now, almost a reaction to that, perhaps, is going back to these traditional styles. I mentioned the Territorials, the thing that the British are not adequately proud enough or even know about enough, you know, to realise that we have this, I think, unique family of cheese. So the cow's milk, they are hard to semi-soft, so hard to a bit crumbly. They tend to be their cloth-bound cylinders. That's unique to British cheesemaking, this binding of cloth. Possibly invented by the Americans, but, you know, never mind. In a sense, there's this paradox for me that one thing that's happening about British cheese in the modern world is a look back to the past and an attempt to refine, save, re-energise some of those traditions of cheese making. And so that, in a sense, is a bit of a movement for me. And so we have some cheeses now. There's some new Wensleydales.
Right.
They are based on pre-war Wensleydale recipe. So are they new or old? And one of the families, I can't remember if it's the Hattons or the Noblets, but they actually found a woman who was, I think, 102, Mrs. Peacock, who remembered making it because there were steps in the recipe that they couldn't understand as modern cheesemakers. Why are you doing that? And what does it do when you do it? And she was able to show you.
Wow, okay.
So it's a sort of odd thing to reach back in the modern world to these traditions and then bring them back up to here and say, are these good? Are they, you know, these are milder cheeses. They take a bit. They're more unassuming. It's a bit harder to market that than something really extremely, really very intense flavour. So that's the thing. The other thing that is this... Okay, so it's a huge issue, and it's a thorny one, and it's one we can spend our whole thing on, is about poverty, rising costs of living, and foods that, like cheddar, used to, in a sense, to be a staple food of people.
Mm.
Ploughman's lunch was invented as a marketing thing in the 70s, but by God, of course, they ate bread and cheese. And cheeses like that are rapidly becoming unaffordable for a lot of people. And it's something I'm beginning to find difficult, that people have to be paid enough. We know that our food has been too cheap, and that's come at a terrible cost. So we know that we that food has different sorts of costs, and ideally we need to pay more for things. We need to pay more in terms of animal welfare. It costs us, you know, financially. But more and more I'm feeling it's harder and harder for me to say, yes, we need to eat like this.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, there's no answer to that, Tom. That is an issue that we all need to approach and think about. And another one.
In this segment, Ned, he actually praises a Syrian refugee who turned cheesemaker, and she was actually a pharmacist before, and now she's a Yorkshire cheesemaker. Her name is Razan Alsous, and her award-winning company is called Yorkshire Dama Cheese, and they make a type of halloumi cheese, they call it squeaky cheese, and the labneh, which is a spreadable yogurt cheese, very popular in the Middle East. Obviously, you can find the products if you go yorkshiredamacheese.co.uk online. And yeah, you would have the chance to taste them.
And think about. And another one that is actually sort of happier in a way is about diversity in farming and cheese making and in cheese mongering. And I think and I hope that I have noticed more and more diversity, but there's a long way to go with that. And that's great, that's fun. Mm. It's fun and interesting. You know, we have I think she's Syrian cheesemaker who came here as a refugee. I think she's a microbiologist. Couldn't get work
yes,
as a microbiologist and is making, I'm going to say all these things wrong. You know, a form of cheese that would look like feta to me, but would be a form of Syrian or Persian feta. By God, she may be Iranian, I apologise. But that is interesting to me. That's just a new thing.
Yeah. That's...
So diversity is in food production and selling, and that is something we need to work on, but in a really joyful way.
Mm.
You know, And it's always, I love the idea of hybrid vigour. That's why I like raw milk cheese. The more bacteria, the higher the bacteria population, the more it fights off the bad bacteria, the more complex the flavours. You know, if one of your strains of starter culture dies, you've got lots of others. I love hybrid vigour. And it's the same for culture. You know, we don't, like, monoculture doesn't work in farming and it doesn't work in humanity either. That's my new, that's how to bring cheese into the modern world.
That's great. That's fantastic. That's a fantastic way to finish our little chat.
Great.
Here in Borough Market.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tom, and thanks for letting me go on. We'll do this a lot more, please.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that was lovely, Ned. Thank you
Great.
So much.
Thanks, Tom.
Cheers. And that's all for me. I've been Thomas Dinas. Thank you once again for listening to the Delicious Legacy podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts and responses, so please head over on Twitter and tell me what you think. You can follow the podcast at The Delicious Legacy, all one word. Or join me on Patreon, where you can put The Delicious Legacy again, one word. And that's Patreon, Patreon.com/ The Delicious Legacy. Or Google Patreon and The Delicious Legacy podcast. This podcast can only keep going with the generous support of our subscribers on Patreon. You guys keep me running, you help me cover my costs, and allow me to dedicate more time researching each episode. I want to thank all of my subscribers for helping so far to create this series. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider going to Patreon and type The Delicious Legacy Podcast and contribute something and keep this podcast running. Thanks for listening. All the best. Over and out.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.